You are listening to The Perks of Being a Book Lover, a show featuring two friends who've been in the same book club for almost 20 years.
I'm Carrie, and my co-host Amy loves to read and recommend books so much that she tries to squeeze in reading two or three more books right before we record a book rec episode. And when she gets overwhelmed, I'm the one who gently reminds her, you did this to yourself.
Or maybe not so gently. I'm Amy, and my co-host Carrie prefers cats to people, mainly because cats leave her alone, unlike me. I'm a very frequent texter, and that kind of drives her crazy.
Only when you say, remember I texted that to you, and then I have to do like the Bob Barker Price is Right wheel and spin it and go back through 3,000 or 4,000 texts. I'm like, oh yeah, I found it right here.
Basically, we're opposites, but we find common ground on our shared love of books. Each week, we chat about what we're reading with each other and sometimes a special guest.
We also dabble in other topics like books in the news, recent book-inspired films, our TBR counts, and general things that tease our brains.
We're so glad you're here with us today. So this week, we're talking about linked short story collections. What are linked short stories, though? They are stories that are collected and somehow linked to each other. That link can be very explicit or it can be very subtle. They can be linked by one character who threads her or his way throughout everyone or who's only mentioned marginally. They can be linked by several characters. They can be linked by setting if they are set in a certain town or state or country or even a house.
But they can also be linked by theme or symbol or a common experience of characters. So they could all be about a shared experience like parenthood or death or love. And sometimes linked short stories do several of these things at once. So we're going to be talking about them this week.
So this episode is a little funny, as you will hear, because this episode was my idea because I love linked short stories. I think that they're a really fun subgenre. Carrie is not so crazy about just short story collections in general. Although, as you hear throughout this episode, by the end, she has come to do what she should do all the time, which is say, yes, Amy, you are right. You're always right.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Or not. But I think that by the end of this episode, your initial reluctance to do an episode about linked short stories was alleviated.
Yes. Well, and I think, I mean, we talk about this with being in book club. You know, sometimes you'll read a book and you'll be like, eh. But then you talk about it with other people and you're like, oh, yeah, I didn't think about that. Or, you know, sometimes you have to sort of do the work of really intentionally thinking about a book beyond just reading it to kind of see, oh, yeah, why was this good? So doing this episode sort of served that purpose for me.
Very good. Well, but first, you and I are very excited because the LA Times Festival of the Book, their schedule came out of the authors who are going to be there and what the different sessions are going to be. And you and I are attending next month, and we are going to be visiting with our other book podcaster friend, Jennifer Calieris from the Books Are My People podcast. And we pored over the schedule and we compared notes. I've sent our list of sessions that we want to go to Jennifer so she can get tickets for us.
Very good.
So I'm very excited. So
you called me yesterday and your question was about, should we try to go to different sessions or should we go to the same session? And I'm like, I want to go to what I want to go to. I mean, and I think this is just kind of the way I make decisions. Like, I'm pretty much like, okay, this. And I don't do a whole lot of debating, you know what I mean? Or I don't have a hard time making a decision. Did you feel like you had a hard time?
Oh, yes. Okay. There were some time slots that there were two or three things that I'd like to go to. I'm interested to see how this book festival works because for almost all the sessions, you need to have a ticket. Now, the tickets are free, but you need to have a ticket in order to attend. And I'm guessing it's because they just have so many people attending mm-hmm. that they couldn't fit all the people who wanted to attend into these halls or rooms or wherever, right? So this is the way that they are controlling the number of people. And so I've never attended one that's like that, unless it's for like a keynote speaker. Most of the ones have not required tickets to go. And I'm not sure how I'm going to like it, because I have been known to go to two that I want to go to, like go to one for part of the time and then go to, or if maybe if it's not thrilling me, then go over to the other one, or, you know, or I decide, oh, well, Carrie's going to this one and it sounds pretty interesting, so maybe I'm going to ditch the one I was originally going to go to and go to that one with her. See, I am not like you. I am not a bam, bam, bam. These are the ones I want to do. I'm very like, and we've talked about this as our personality. I'm very like, loosey-goosey, you know, just like whatever I'm feeling at the time. And this is making me have to decide. And I am not sure. I almost thought, I wonder if Jennifer can get me tickets to a couple different ones. And then I can decide when I get there. I don't know.
Oh, shoot.
Okay, let's see. What else we have on our agenda? I have no new things I have watched. In fact, I'm not sure I watched anything all week long. But you are like in your movie mode. You,
I am.
Your husband and your son are in the movie watching mode. And
we are.
I want to hear about it.
So Friday night, we went ahead and bought Oppenheimer, because like you can see it, but you have to rent it or you have to buy it. So we went ahead and bought it. Our daughter has seen it two or three times. Dean has seen it two or three times. And after having watched it myself, it is a movie that you can watch repeatedly, I think. So we watched Oppenheimer and it was amazing. It didn't feel like 3 hours. The pacing of it was great. It gives you a lot to think about. It just so much to think about. And Cillian Murphy was awesome. Robert Downey Jr. was awesome. I can see why it won all the Academy Awards. And then last night we watched Spaceman, which is based on the book Spaceman of Bohemia by Jaroslav Kalfar. And that was published in 2017.
It's been a long time ago, but you talked about this book on the podcast.
Yeah, I read it in 2020. And so this movie stars Adam Sandler and Carey Mulligan. And I liked it. I actually liked it more than the book. You know, the thing is, it's definitely not a movie for everybody. So in the book, there's a guy up in space and he's all by himself. And there's this character that comes into the story. It's like this giant spider. And in the story, you're not entirely sure if the spider is real, like if it's an alien spider or if it's just a figment of his imagination, just as a coping mechanism and a survival tool. Well, in the movie, I mean, I guess you could say that the spider might not be real, but, you know, because it's like this giant spider, you sort of assume that it's real. And because of that, some people might watch it and be like, oh, well, this is dumb. A giant spider in space, you know, how'd it get in? You know what I'm saying? Like some people might watch the movie and be like, this is kind of silly. But I kind of liked it because I felt like sometimes reading the book, I was like, I'm not sure what's going on. Whereas I felt like I could track what was happening better from the movie. So
I mean, Adam Sandler is known for his silly kind of juvenile comedies, a majority. Now, he has done some serious things like Uncut Gems and some other things. So is this movie have any humor
No. It is not silly. It is not Adam Sandler as a comedic actor. It is Adam Sandler in a serious role.
Okay.
And I thought he did a good job, you know, because I wasn't watching it thinking Adam Sandler is a comedian. He did well enough that I believed it.
Yeah, you forget that he did Happy Gilmore.
Yeah.
All those things, yeah.
Right.
Well, interesting.
But you said you haven't had time for reading, but you have been doing some activities in your home.
I have been. I've been doing some spring cleaning. And spring cleaning feels so good, but it does not come naturally to me necessarily, because I will admit, I think I might have some hoarding tendencies. I would say my parents are borderline hoarders. Mom, sorry if you're listening to this, but you and Dad are borderline hoarders. And I think I have gotten I'm not as bad as they are. You know, I can definitely get rid of things, but you get rid of things constantly. Mm-hmm. I have to be like in the mindset. I have to be in the mood, and then it's all systems go.
I have a question. Yeah. So do you hang on to stuff with the idea that maybe I'll want this again, or maybe one of the kids will use it at some point? Or do you not get rid of stuff because you're like, I don't feel like dealing with it now?
It's a little bit of both.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes I think, oh, well, I might need that for something later. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes, what's that Marie Kondo thing?
If
it sparks joy. Now, sometimes something will spark joy, but I just don't need it. You know, mm-hmm. like, for instance, I really like handmade things. And so I have, I don't know how many handmade crocheted blankets that I have sort of collected over the years that I thought were pretty. And, but how many crocheted blankets do I need? Right. Mm-hmm. They spark joy, but I just don't need that many. So that's sort of my thing. I am a collector, which is another word of saying I'm a borderline hoarder. So I listened to a podcast recently. It's from the Ologies. I think I've mentioned this podcast before, Ologies with Ali Ward. And they had a guest on there. Actually, there were two guests in this episode about organization. They had a couple on there who runs an organization company that you can hire, and they'll go in and you know, help you organize. And then they also had, I can't remember if he was a psychologist or a sociologist. What he was saying is that people who have a hard time making decisions are more likely to be clutterers. Mm. And so I am a clutterer. For you, it's easy to say, yep, I don't need that. Yep, I do need that. You know, mm-hmm. For me, it's harder. It's harder for me to make those decisions. Mm-hmm. But another thing that they said was that, I guess in Marie Kondo's book, she says, you know, touch it. And if it brings you joy, keep it. This scientist said that actually don't do that. That if you touch something, you are more likely to want to keep it. Maybe if you touch it, it brings back, you know, memories, or it evokes some kind of emotion or thought in you. Whereas mm-hmm. somebody just shows it to you, or somebody says, I'm going to get rid of this thing in the other room.
And you don't see it or touch it,
you might be like, okay. But then as soon as you touch it, you've made a connection with it.
Mm.
Now, maybe that wouldn't matter for you because you're hardcore. But for somebody like me, that is really good advice. Don't touch mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have been doing some spring cleaning. And I will say, though, I feel so much better when I get rid of all that stuff. It's liberating. And there definitely are endorphins that you release, you know, when you do that. When I think that you are on an endorphin rush.
Like, that's all how the you time.
Get your, yeah, that's how you get your endorphin rush. And so, yeah, I'm trying to be better.
Well, but, you know, I wonder if, you know how I have a thing about like crossing things off my list and getting things done? Because that's like mental clutter. And so I think that for me, part of the reason I like just, okay, do this, do this, do this, and checking it off is, it probably does give me some kind of endorphin rush. It gives me a sense of satisfaction, like, okay, I've done this. The clutter is gone. I can let it go. So, I mean, that would kind of make sense. Because for me, a lot of physical clutter makes my head feel like emotionally cluttered, or you know what I mean? Like there's a connection there for me, at least, between if there's a bunch of physical stuff in my space, it does something to me mentally too. So
I'm a ditherer. I need to call that better health and get a, you know, an online therapist or something. Or I could just talk to you, Carrie, and all of our listeners and just tell you all.
There you go. Yeah.
So Carrie, mm-hmm. you know, let's get back to books.
Okay.
What have you been reading lately?
So it was February, I guess, the Louisville Free Public Library for their Books and Brews had an event. February is Black History Month. And so it was a locally owned tea shop owned by a Black entrepreneur. So they had a lot of books. One of the books that they had was We Are Never Meeting in Real Life by Samantha Irby. And I love the title of that because I am all about not meeting up with people in real life. And also there is this kind of unhappy looking cat on the cover. I think I found the perfect book. And then I opened the book up and was perusing it. And I really love the opening line of one of the essays. Anyway, after doing that, I decided to listen to the audiobook of We Are Never Meeting in Real Life by Samantha Irby. So this is a collection of her essays that covers a lot of ground. She talks about her job working for 15 years at a vet clinic. She talks about her childhood with her sickly mother and her drunken, abusive father. She has essays about her dating relationships with men. She has essays about her relationship with a woman whom she later moves in with. And she has one about what it's like for her living in a house with children when she moves in with her female partner, who I believe is now her wife. She has to deal with children, and she's never had her own children, never wanted her own children. So I think Irby does a really nice job of blending humor and poignancy in many of her essays. And even though, you know, I mean, it's very clear that she and I are very different people, I totally get her "why would I want to be around people because they suck" ethos. So I sort of felt like in some ways this collection was a spot on choice for me. I was sold with the title, I was sold with the cover, and I was sold with the contents. So We Are Never Meeting in Real Life by Samantha Irby. Good stuff there. What about you?
I read a historical fiction novel, perfect for a foodie, and I would put myself in that category. It's called Good Taste by Carolyn Scott. And this is set in England in 1932, and our main character is Stella, and she's this independent, single woman who makes a living writing articles for women magazines about, like, the best way to get a coffee stain out of your shirt, or ideas on ways to use up leftover mashed potatoes and things like that. And she recently published a biography of this little-known female British cookbook author from the 1800s that most readers found dreadfully dull, and it didn't sell very well. So when her editor in London summons her to a meeting with him, she is sure that he's going to drop her like a hot potato. But to her surprise, he has a new project for her. He would like her to write a history of English cuisine and how the English like to eat. And at this moment in time, it's during the Depression. People need a little, like, lift me up. And so her editor wants her to write this book with, like, a little bit of a, like, a rah, rah, you know, go feel, like, reminding the countrymen and women why it is wonderful to be quintessentially English. So Stella takes this project on with gusto, and she travels across the countryside eating and trying scones and eel pies and oatcakes. But there are complications, like she's in love with her best friend Michael, who announces that he is engaged to a truly horrible society queen. So she decides to explore her own romantic choices and becomes involved with an antiques dealer named Freddie, who she later finds his life philosophies may not match up with her own. Oh, and then her father shows up on her doorstep one day and says, "Surprise, I'm moving in with you."
Oh my God.
One aspect of this book that I really enjoyed, Stella sends in little ads to lots of little town papers asking people for their family recipes. And so in between the chapters, you get to see the letters that people wrote into her about, you know, "Oatcakes can only be made the way that my grandmother made them," or, oh, you know, different things like that. And so those were really fun, hearing people talk about the dishes from their family or from their childhood. All in all, this was a fun, delightful book that I think people who really enjoyed the Guernsey literary and potato peel society would enjoy. And when I say it is for foodies, let's face it, historically, English food is not known for being incredibly tasty when stacked up against others, but it was kind of wickedly fun to hear about all these horrible dishes that had these strange parts of animals, or like blackbird tart, you know, where they would put live animals in the in the food. Anyway, it was a lot of fun. I listened to the audiobook, and the audiobook was very engaging, and I would recommend it. So again, that's Good Taste by Carolyn Scott.
I mean, I'm a pretty adventurous eater, but eel pie just
sounds
really
disgusting,
doesn't do it for me.
Yeah,
and I've eaten guinea pig and haggis.
That is true.
So
that is true. So, you know, we need to get on to these short
get
stories.
Get cracking.
But before we do, let's hear from a fellow book lover about their five-star read.
My name is Anastasia Cody from Kilkenny, Ireland, and my five-star read is going to be Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. And my reason for this, in Charlotte's own words, she set out to create a hero out of a seemingly regular girl, this governess who came from poverty, who seemingly had no prospects, and yet inside her was this fierce spirit, this intelligent, interesting person. And to this day, she is still just as iconic. Go and read this book. It is incredible. And one of my all-time favorites. Thanks for having me on, guys.
So this week we are talking about linked short stories, and I will admit this was my idea because I really enjoy linked short stories. Regular short story collections are sort of hit or miss for me, but I guess I like the form of a linked short story collection because it gives me something just like a theme or something to wrap my head around that maybe a regular short story collection doesn't have. And so you collected information about linked short stories, Carrie. You did some digging.
I did. So linked short stories have actually been around longer than you might expect. I was kind of intrigued when I went on this deep dive. So you've heard of the Canterbury Tales, right?
Yeah.
So those are from the 14th century, written by Geoffrey Chaucer. Now, technically, they are poems, but they're long narrative poems. And so I'm going to slot them into the linked short stories. But then there's also the Decameron, which was written in the 1300s by Giovanni Boccaccio. And that consists of 100 stories told by men and women about the Black Death.
Oh my God, that sounds like a book you would want to read.
I know.
100 stories about the Black Death. I bet you added it to your TBR, didn't you?
I didn't, but I have to admit that was a big selling point for me. I was like, maybe I will add it.
I'm more of a Canterbury Tales girl because there's some jolly stories and ribald stories, you know, in the Canterbury Tales. Priest and the washerwoman.
And the knight.
And they're all traveling to Canterbury and they each tell their tale.
Right.
I love that.
Yeah. Right. But the thing is about linked short stories is that they don't sell as well as novels do. So why do you think that is? Let's play a little quiz. Why do you think that is?
Because I think most readers want a traditional storyline, like an A to Z with a rising conflict and then resolution and a plot. And some of these don't necessarily, their structure's a little different.
Yes.
So I think that's one thing.
Yes. Now, I mean, I would say for the most part, they have, you know, the exposition and then they have the rising action and then they have the climax and they have the denouement, you know, but it's condensed. Right. And so it's a lot shorter. And so you don't get the depth of a plot or the depth of a conflict or the depth of character and sort of character exploration that you would get with a novel. But I think part of it, too, like a lot of things with publishing, it's harder to market. You know, I mean, I think that's why a lot of books, even novels, you know, sometimes the people who are selling them and marketing them don't really know where to put them. And so I think that linked short story collections sometimes, or really any short story collection, gets stuck into that. They don't really know what to do with them.
Well, and as I was culling my list down, what I realized is some of the ones that have become pretty popular, people may not know that they're linked short stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm thinking of Olive Kittredge by Elizabeth Strout. Those are linked short stories, but it's not really advertised as such.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so I think if you call them a novel and stories, people are more likely to read it than if you say this is a linked short story collection.
Right. Right.
So it's a little bit of the marketing.
So what do you think the positives of linked short stories are?
Well, I can tell you why I like them. They're sort of a glimpse into a life for that particular moment. So, okay, this is maybe going to sound creepy, but I like walking my dogs at night because, you know, people have their lights on in their house and it's dark and you can see almost like a little vignette in somebody's house. Now, maybe mm-hmm. that sounds creepy. I'm not going up to their window peering in. I'm just talking about walking by, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like you can kind of imagine what's going on in that house right about that minute. So that kind of reminds me of these. A lot of these are like glimpses into a period of time for this particular person or this particular house or this particular community. And there's something to me that I enjoy about that, who I can fill in the blanks. So I don't have to have a complete story arc, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I feel like I can fill that in for myself a little bit. But I know the short stories are not your favorite.
As a general rule, no. For me, it is that I have a hard time remembering them, unless it's a story that I have read, usually because I've taught it. You know, if there's a story that I've read over and over and over again, I have a hard time remembering them. So for me, I sort of need to be immersed in a 200, 300, 400 page book about a couple characters where I'm sort of focused on them and what they're doing. I just find that I don't remember short story collections very well. Even if they're linked, I struggle to remember them. But I think for a writer, linked short story collections can be really fun. And for readers too, because I do think they allow for some experimentation and in terms of the style or the concept or how they're written. And it's a good way to explore different characters. You know, like if you're writing a novel, you're committed to that protagonist or that villain or, you know, whatever you have in that story. Whereas if you're writing linked short stories or you're reading them, you're being exposed to lots of different characters. And then, you know, I mean, really, in terms of like, if you're thinking in terms of education, short stories are how we teach all the different parts of stories. You know, that's usually how we start. We don't start with kids and give them a huge novel. You know, we start with little stories, and that's how you teach what happens. So it's kind of the basis for everything we do in literature.
Huh. I remember the very first linked short story collection I ever read, and it was very memorable to me. It was The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien, which I think won the Pulitzer Prize. I read it in college, I think. And it is a group of linked short stories about a platoon that went to Vietnam. It's been a long time since I read it, but basically some of the things that they carried with them and what those things meant to them. And I just remember being incredibly moved by that book. And that's what started me on my quest to read linked short stories.
Hmm. I think probably the first book of linked short stories I read would have been Dubliners by James Joyce.
Yeah. James Joyce doesn't make it easy for any reader.
Right. He has a certain style that not everybody loves. And I am one of the people who's, you know, not a huge James Joyce fan. So maybe that was what did it for me. I'm kind of like, oh, Lord, this really isn't my jam. Now, I do end up sometimes reading linked short story collections on accident because I don't know that they're linked short stories, but I wouldn't say I make a beeline to them. So when you first suggested we do this, I was like, I'm going to have to prepare for 6 or 8 or 10 months so that I can actually have something to talk about.
I had so many to choose from. It was hard for me to pare it down. And I wanted to talk about different kinds. So it was hard for me to select, Carrie, because I had so many. Okay, let's say you do like these books that you read, right?
Yes.
Okay,
I did.
Even though it is not a go-to genre for you,
right?
You have some suggestions of linked short story collections that other people might also find enjoyable.
Yes. And I would say, since I don't gravitate towards it, maybe you should listen to my recommendations more than they should listen to yours, because maybe that gives some weight and gravitas to what I'm going to say. Right.
Okay.
So the first one is called Dear Chrysanthemums by Fiona Z. Lorraine. I did like this one because I noticed a trend in the ones that I read. A lot of them are about other places, like they're not set in the U.S. And so this book takes place in several countries, China, Singapore, France, and the U.S., and it takes place across a time frame from 1946 to 2016. And it covers a lot of cultural ground. So one of the stories is about the Cultural Revolution in China. And another one is about the Tiananmen Square massacre. And I sort of love a book about another place because I end up learning a lot. There will be something that's discussed in the story and I'm like, I don't know who that person is, or I don't know what they're talking about. And so then I go down a little Googling hole. But the focus of these stories, what connects them is women. So one woman in one of the stories is a dancer who is sent to an apartment building for re-education. And she will only likely leave this apartment building in a coffin. Ooh. So she's a dancer. She's a free thinker. Probably she sees some of the other apartment dwellers leaving in coffins. So another story is about the cook of the former first lady of China and sort of what that was like being in the household and having to serve the first lady. And some of the connections between these women are subtle, which I actually kind of like because it's almost like a mystery. Right? Mm-hmm. It's like you start out and you read a story, and then a couple stories later, something will come up and it's very subtle. And I was like, wait a minute. You know, it's like my brain starts puzzling and I start going, okay, who is this? And so then I would backtrack. And so that was kind of fun and enjoyable. Some linked short story collections, the connections are very obvious, right? And some of them are very subtle. And so I would say that in this book, Dear Chrysanthemums, they tend to be more subtle, which is kind of like puzzling it together. So that one's called Dear Chrysanthemums by Fiona Z. Lorraine.
So you're talking about seeing some trends in the books you chose. And I also saw major trends in the books that I chose.
Okay.
Mine were mainly collections that highlighted diverse voices. The first one I'm going to talk about is The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. This one is a classic. I think people would call it a modern classic. It's 50 years old this year, and it has been taught in countless classrooms. And it was a groundbreaking book at the time for literature written by Hispanic women, kind of bringing that more to the forefront. So in this book, it's set in Chicago, and it's the story of a young Latina girl named Esperanza Cordero, and her story is told in small vignettes. The book itself is very short, but even the stories themselves are fairly short. They're kind of lyrical. They're almost poetic, and these stories culminate in her learning about herself and growing up and also being proud of where you come from. It's been a little while since I have read this book, but I actually on the waiting list at the library to get the audiobook copy because I would like to reread it since it's having its anniversary this year. And I have heard that the audio is really good. It's narrated by the author herself. And like I said, because it's sort of lyrical, I would really like to hear somebody read it. I think that will be a rich experience. So again, the name of that one is The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. Okay, Carrie, so what's next? Do we have another country?
Yes, I will give you another one by an author that the stories are set in other places. So this book is called Birth Canal by Dias Novita Wuri. Dias Novita Wuri is an Indonesian author who translated this work into English. And so, as the title suggests, Birth Canal, the heart of the stories is women, sex, pregnancy, and or birth. So what I like about this collection, and as I mentioned with the chrysanthemum, is that, you know, you learn a lot about other places and historic events. So for instance, in Birth Canal, one of the stories is about women who were forced into prostitution by the Japanese military during World War II, and they were called comfort women. And they numbered somewhere between 50,000 and 200,000 women who were essentially forced into prostitution. And the majority of the women who were subjected to this were Korean, but there were also women from Indonesia, Australia, Burma, China, the Netherlands, the Philippines, and Japan. So all of these women were exploited. You know, I just found that really, I mean, disgusting and disheartening, but also it was a piece of history that I didn't know anything about. And I don't know that I would have found out about it had I not read this collection. So each of the four sections of Birth Canal is about women determining whether and how to bring children into a world that's dominated by men who often do not care for the women or the children in their midst. So if you're interested in stories about mothers and children and how pregnancy affects them, I think this is a great choice. So again, it's called Birth Canal by Dias Novita Wuri.
Are most of the stories set in Indonesia or in Asia?
In Asia.
In Asia. I think maybe I am reading different kinds than you are because, okay, so I'll talk about my next one, but most of mine sometimes read like a novel. There's just gaps in there. So the next one I'm going to talk about is called There There by Tommy Orange. And this is a book that's made up of collected stories that examine the lives of the modern day, and I'm putting in air quotes, urban Indian. And that's the way he describes it in the book. So there's a cast of characters. All of them are Native American to some degree, and they are making their way to Oakland, California for a national powwow to celebrate Native American heritage. Now, the characters all seem unrelated at first, but as the story continues, we find that they are all inextricably linked, even if in a very small way. So some characters may know very little about their Native heritage, while others have been taught about it by family members, but many of them feel lost because they don't have a connection with their heritage or community. So the history here that Orange is using is the American Indian Urban Relocation Program of the 1950s. And that's when the American government thought that moving Native Americans off their reservations and into big cities would help them be more successful as a whole. But unfortunately, they were not trained for the type of jobs that were available there because their communities focused mainly on agriculture. And in large cities, Native Americans didn't have the benefit of a strong knit community like they had on their reservations. Thus, we come to our characters, and a part of their heritage has been lost to the contemporary generation. It did start out a little slow, but in the second half, it really speeds up. And there is a big climax conflict that changes everyone. But again, there's a cast of characters and the stories alternate between who they're about. It, you know, it's a little bit like Canterbury Tales. All these different characters are making their way to this powwow, not together, because we don't know that they know each other, but that's the progression of the story. And then the climax is at the powwow. So
that's part of the theme, right? This journey.
Right.
The journey is the theme, but it's also a journey, like it's a physical journey, but it's also like an emotional, mental, intellectual,
yes,
cultural journey too.
Yes, absolutely. Tommy Orange has a new book out. It's been highly anticipated. It's called Wandering Stars, but I think that this one is in a more standard novel form. So again, the name of that one is There There by Tommy Orange. And I think this one was nominated for a Pulitzer. I don't know that it won. And it was his debut novel.
I remember reading that because one of my students read it and recommended it to me. If a student recommends a book, I always try to make sure I read it because I've had very good luck that way finding some awesome books.
Well, what did you think of it?
I enjoyed it. And really, you know, I was just checking the list. I've actually read three of the ones you're talking about because I've read There. I've read The House on Mango Street, and I've read one of the other ones I think you're going to talk about. So I guess I should say I do read them. You know, so we talked about how some linked short story books are connected by theme, right? Like Birth Canal is by theme. And then Chrysanthemums, like some of the characters would reappear in other stories. So this one that I'm going to talk about is actually connected by the setting. It's called What Makes You Think You're Supposed to Feel Better by Jody Hobbs Hester. And I sort of love that title. What Makes You Think You're Supposed to Feel Better? Yeah. I love it. What connects all the stories is the setting of a small town in Virginia. That's the backdrop to all these stories. So it's a debut collection. It was easy to get into because the first story is about a young mom who learns about the death of her neighbor. And he was a man she never knew. And he kept himself like super isolated. He never spoke to anybody else. And that prompts her to think about how she both wishes for some solitude because she is a young mother you know, and when you're in that phase of your life, you can't eat alone, you can't pee alone, you can't sleep alone, you're never alone. And so she has this wish for solitude, but also kind of this fear of solitude. So I thought that was a kind of a good choice to start the collection. Another story is about a man whose wife is in the intensive care unit, and he spends his time there with her thinking about a love affair from long ago and sort of the regrets he has. And so all of the stories showcase this desire for connection and people's failure to actually connect. So I guess it is linked in two ways. It's linked by the setting, but it's also linked by this desire for connection and yet an inability to connect. So What Makes You Think You're Supposed to Feel Better by Jodi Hobbs Hester.
So my next one is The Secret Lives of Church Ladies by Disha Filia. And this book is linked in that all the stories are about Black women and also about religion and church and sometimes how those things connect. So Black culture and church, there's a foundation there, right? So the foundation of culture that many Black women's lives have been built around is the church. But many of these stories question the usefulness of that foundation and the happiness of the women in these stories. And when I say that it's challenging the usefulness, I'm referring to the church as an institution, not so much God, because, you know, God and church are kind of two totally separate things. But if you were thinking, because of the title, that this book refers to church ladies and that this will be a fairly sanitized book, you would be mistaken about that.
They have obviously never met any church ladies.
Because these stories are about relationships, lesbian relationships, adulterous relationships, heterosexual relationships, the full gamut. Because the truth is that even though the church says we're all sinners, what they often project is that their members lead virtuous lives. And we all know that that isn't, you know, accurate. So behind closed doors, or maybe doors cracked open a bit, everyone is human. So The Secret Lives of the Church Ladies is just as messy as any other. And these stories are about how desire and religion can butt up against one another. I listened to this on audiobook and I thought it was fantastic. But I wouldn't recommend listening to this in the car with your kids or even your mother, because there is a lot of sex in here and, you know, salty language. And sometimes the problem for me with a regular short story collection is that it can be really uneven. Like maybe some stories you're going to love and other stories you don't like that much at all. I thought all these stories were fantastic. And I can't really think of a story in this collection that I didn't enjoy. And I thought she was particularly good at dialogue. Like I said, the audiobook was great. It was narrated by Janina Edwards. And so it's about 4 hours long. You know, it's not a super long listen. So, you know, get on that. It's good. This book was a finalist for the National Book Award in 2020.
That's a win.
Yeah.
I love it.
The name of it again is The Secret Lives of Church Ladies by Disha Filia.
All right. So I'm up.
You're up.
The next book I'm going to talk about actually won the Pulitzer Prize in 2011. It is A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan.
I love this one. We fought over who got to talk about this one.
And I won.
You won. Yeah.
Every character in the story is connected somehow to Benny Salazar, who's an executive with a record company, and his assistant, Sasha. The story spans something like 30 years, beginning in the 1970s. And so while some of the stories go beyond the music business, many of them are in that world. Like one of the stories is about a magazine interview, and another one is about memories of bands just kind of getting started. And one of the bands had a very memorable name. They were called the Flaming Dildos. And so, you know, well, you can't not love that band name. So this is a book that if you're a music lover now, or have been at any point in your life dating back to, like, you know, the ancient days of the late 1900s, then this is a book that you'll like. I mean, it won a major award, so take that for what it's worth. A lot of people liked it. A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan.
There were a couple things I liked about that. I listened to the audiobook of that one as well. And the audiobook is really good. And it kind of reminds me of Six Degrees of Separation, or, you know, like everyone is somehow go back to Kevin Bacon in some way. Mm-hmm. But that's what this book reminded me of, because, okay, maybe the first story been about Benny Salazar. But then the next story talks about his wife and his kid, and they have a babysitter. Well, the next story might be about the babysitter.
Right.
And then the next story might be about the mom of the babysitter. But anyway, it all kind of links back to Benny Salazar. Anyway, I loved it. It's sort of like a puzzle. Really enjoyed it.
All right. What do you have next?
I have one of my favorite books ever, Homegoing by Yaa Gyasi. It follows the story of two sisters from the same mother in Ghana during the height of the slave trade. One stays in Africa because she's married off to one of the British soldiers, and the other is captured and sold as a slave sent to America. And so this book follows the descendants of these two women up until present day. And so it's alternating chapters or stories with a different descendant of these two original sisters. So you would think that it perhaps could be overwhelming to keep track of so many characters, but the way that Gyasi handles this is just so skillful that for me, it was almost a seamless read. So you really only get a snapshot of each descendant's story in a single chapter that's dedicated to them. And I would say that the overarching theme of this book is that the original sin of slavery is a travesty that cannot be erased within a few generations. It stains both the whites and the Africans who sold fellow blacks from the other tribes to the whites. But I loved the structure of this. And so when we were talking about what were some of the pros of doing link short stories or a novel in stories, this would be one of them, because the way that she has structured this to have a, you know, alternating chapters of these descendants and how each of these families ended up, it would be hard to do in a traditional form. Mm-hmm. And I love this book, Homegoing by Yaa Gyasi.
That was the other one I've read.
And what'd you think of that one?
I did like that one too.
I feel like a lot of mine have a narrative through line, whereas
a lot of mine don't.
Right.
There's only really two that have characters.
Yeah.
That or try.
I think all of them, but one of mine do.
Yeah. But so. I think that's good, because I think that we're offering a lot of different options. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, what's up for you?
This is my last one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So this one, I actually picked it because of the cover. The cover is really vibrant green and just really eye-catching. So it is called Music of the Swamp by Lewis Norden. And so I had no idea what this was about. These stories connect characters and setting. So I sort of loved the protagonist who is in most of these stories. His name is Sugar Mecklen. Isn't that a great name?
Sugar Mecklen.
Yeah. And he is a boy who lives in the Mississippi Delta with his parents. His father is a drunk and his mother is a put upon housewife. And he shares the tales of their relationship with sort of this mix of rose colored adoration and stark acceptance of their frailties and stupidity. It's sad and bleak in the way that a lot of Southern stories tend to be, but it's also quite funny. So reading this, the character of Sugar Mecklen reminded me a lot of Dill in To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm. So if you've read To Kill a Mockingbird, the character of Dill is just, he's just really funny, right? And the character of Dill is based on Truman Capote. And so Sugar Mecklen reminded me of Dill. So I would say if you like To Kill a Mockingbird, this is a book that I think you would like, because it is set in the South and it has a sort of an endearing young boy as the narrator. Again, and that's Music of the Swamp by Lewis Norden.
Cool. I've never heard of that one.
All right. What's your last one?
I have, well, it's sort of a last one, or maybe a last one and a half. I read two that.
Really? You're squeezing an additional one in?
It might be. Yeah. Because I read two very close together and I'm like, I love both of these, but they have a similar storyline. And so I felt like I didn't want to necessarily talk about, I am going to talk about both, but I'm going to kind of lump them together. So the two books are Crooked Hallelujah by Kelly Jo Ford and Fried Plantains by Zelinka Reed Benta. So with both of these, the theme is mother-daughter relationships. So in the first one, Crooked Hallelujah, it's a collection of short stories about four generations of women on the Cherokee Reservation in Oklahoma. And in our opening story is set in 1970s, and Justine is a 15-year-old girl whose mother is a holy roller, where any skin showing is a sin, an amusement park is of this world, and TV is not allowed. And her mother, Lula, is a single mother of four daughters whose husband left her for a younger white woman. So Lula's mother, Nana, is a stable force for Justine and later Justine's daughter, Rennie. So this collection goes chronological. We follow primarily Justine and Rennie as they leave Oklahoma to try to make a new life in Texas, but they are often drawn back to Oklahoma. But boiled down to its essence, the story is about mothers and daughters and their complicated relationships. And also, if you ask me, it's a bit about how religion can really mess people up. But I really like this collection, Crooked Hallelujah by Kelly Jo Ford. But the second one, Fried Plantain by Zelinka Reed Benta, is also about the complicated relationships about mother-daughters. But in this case, it is about a girl named who is from a Jamaican-Canadian family. They live in Toronto. And it's about her grandmother and her mother and her. And it starts when she is about 8, and it goes up until she graduates high school. And each of these stories sort of shows the struggle that her mother has, both with her mother, Nana, and with, she's desperate for her daughter not to make the same mistake that she did, which was to get pregnant at 17. But in some ways, that's kind of ruined her relationship with her mother. And it's, you know, in some ways ruining her relationship with her daughter. But my daughter-in-law is Jamaican. And so I've been wanting to read more books by Jamaican writers. And so reading this, actually where this character's family is from in Jamaica is where my daughter-in-law is from. And so I recognized a lot of the terms that they use. There is a little bit of patois in here, especially when the grandmother talks, because she talks, you know, more of a Jamaican patois than the other two. So there is a little bit of that. Sometimes that bothers people, but I enjoyed it. I had a connection to it because I could recognize some of those things. So I'm lumping those two together. Mother-daughters can be really complicated. Mm-hmm. So that's Crooked Hallelujah and Fried Plantain.
So you had mother-daughters, you had diverse voices, and you had religion. Would you say those are kind of the three big, like...
I also feel like when I was looking at them, a lot of them are like coming of age, young people into adulthood, sort of their progression. And yours are death and... What are yours again? And other countries. And...
No. Okay, so women and motherhood, isolation... and family dysfunction or dysfunction in general, you know, the topics I love. So no, actually, I feel this is Carrie eating crow episode. Carrie not wanting to do this episode and then Carrie going, oh, well, yeah, okay, I liked all these. So maybe Carrie should shut up about Amy's ideas sometimes. So
sometimes Amy has good ideas.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Even if it's not a good idea, I don't have any ideas. So even a bad idea is better than, what do I toss forward? Nothing. Here's a big ball of nothing. Okay, what can we do with that? So Amy, if I need to eat crow, I will eat crow. I am not resistant to that. So I'm eating the crow. I'm putting A1 sauce on it, which reminds me a little bit of the type of food you mentioned earlier in this episode.
Yeah.
In that historical fiction. Eating crow still sounds better than eel pie. I will try in future to not be so grumpy about some of your ideas, because I think this is a good episode.
Okay, well, I'm glad that you admit that, I'm right. You admit that I'm right. Before we end our episode, though, we are going to talk about a book that we've added to our TBR, and then we are going to hear from Nora, Carrie's daughter. We're having her back to talk about a book that she found notable lately in the fantasy romance area, which is not one that you and I read a lot of. And so we'd like to hear from listeners who read more in those areas than we do.
So, hey, Nora, what have you been reading lately?
So I actually read this a while ago in January. It's Gwen and Art Are Not in Love by Lex Croucher. And I got it as an ARC from a Goodreads giveaway. So I felt pretty fancy. And basically, this story, it's kind of like a King Arthur retelling. So it follows Arthur, not actually like Arthur Pendragon, like a descendant of Arthur Pendragon.
Oh, okay. So that's the Art of...
Yes, okay. His like nickname is okay. Art. And he is betrothed to Lady Gwendolyn, who's like the princess of this kingdom. And they've been betrothed since birth, but they tease each other a lot. Like, they don't really get along. But they're supposed to get married, so they are just kind of dealing with that.
This isn't set in modern times.
No, this is set in, like, England, in, like, that time period. Okay. So they're supposed to get married. However, there's a twist on it where you think, oh, well, Gwendolyn and Arthur might fall in love. You know, they might get over their differences and fall in love. But no, actually, because Art is not into Gwendolyn. He gets basically caught kissing a boy. And so now they're, like, trying to deal with that because, you know, that's not really okay in that time period. Mm-hmm. But then Gwendolyn also has a crush on the lady knight, whose name is Bridget, I think. And so they kind of like ally with each other and blackmail each other. And it's a very funny story. I like annotated it and I have all these like orange tabs and that means funny. It was very like a laugh out loud book.
All right. Well, that book sounds really good. So what's on your TBR? Do you have anything that you're excited to read?
Well, I'm really excited to finish the Throne of Glass series because I've read 5 books out of that series. It has 8 books. But the next 2 I'm supposed to read, it's recommended to tandem read them because the stories take place like simultaneously. So one book follows a bunch of different characters. And the other book follows just, I think, one character, but it happens at the same time.
So when you say tandem read, you mean read them at the same time?
Yes. And some lovely person has, like, coordinated all the chapters to read in order, like, of those 2 books together. So I'm really excited to read it. I'm just very intimidated because it's basically like reading either, depends on how you look at it, but one big book at the same time when it's actually, like, 2 separate books.
And who's the author of that series?
Sarah J. Maas. Very, very popular, but she is a fantastic writer.
All right. Well, maybe something you can work on after you finish your English paper.
Okay. Yes, definitely.
Have you added any new books to your TBR, Carrie?
I actually have. I have recently finished teaching students. I teach a middle school geography class this year, and we were learning about Australia and New Zealand. Now, I went down a little bit of a hole into finding New Zealand authors because I am fascinated by the haka and the face tattoos that a lot of Maori people have. It's an important part of their culture. And so I found a book, it's called The Bone People by Carrie Holm. And I don't really know much about it, but how you can find those lists of books by New Zealand authors, you know, or indigenous New Zealand authors. Actually, I'm not sure if this author is Maori, but it won the Booker Award. So I was kind of like, oh, well, I might have to check that out. But it's called The Bone People. It's set in New Zealand. It's about the complicated relationships between 3 outcasts of mixed European and Maori heritage. So I thought that sounded pretty interesting. What about you?
Yeah. So I think I've mentioned about a podcast that I've been listening to, but it's called Book of the Day. It's produced by NPR. And they collect all the different small interviews that they do with authors about their books, like across all of their shows. And they'll air one a day. And so they're very short. These are like 8 to maybe 15 minute long interviews with the author about their book. And I have added a lot of books to my TBR from this podcast. And one recently sounded really fascinating to me. It's The Extinction of Irina Ray by Jennifer Croft. And it is about this author who has written this magnum opus type of book. And there are translators who were translating it from 8 different languages they are coming to her property that's on this wild forest outside of Poland. And it sounds like there's some like intrigue going on. I'm not totally sure what the plot line is, mm-hmm. but what I will say is that translation kind of intrigues me. The funny thing is I don't read that many books in translation. I just find the process of translation interesting because sometimes they're translating the feel of something, not so much word for word. And so
how do you do that?
How do you do that? And, you know, there are definitely bad translations of books. There are good translations of books. And how do you not put some of your own art into it? You know, that maybe the author didn't intend. Anyway, I'm sort of fascinated by the art of translation. It sounds like there's some thriller type aspects to this book, which I'm inquisitive about. So that one is The Extinction of Irina Ray by Jennifer Croft.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode and we'll see you next week.
Happy reading. For show notes for any episode, go to our website at perksofbeingabooklover.com. We're also on Instagram at perksofbeingabookloverpod and on Facebook at perksofbeingabooklover. To send us a message, go to our website and click the contact button.
And if you enjoy listening to us each week, tell a friend or write us a review on your favorite podcast platform to help other book lovers find us.
Finally, a huge thank you to Forward Radio 106.5 FM, a grassroots community radio station in Louisville, Kentucky. You can find our show there, live or in archives at forwardradio.org.